You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Hello, friends. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to Barbara Hempel. We talk about how listening to what people were talking about on the playground helped her launch a business and later an association, lots of things. If you are a longtime listener, I would love for you, based on what you know about the other shows I've done, to just make a quick note in your mind, like when you think this might have happened, sitting on the playground, launching a business, like what decade do you think that this took place? So if you are a person who has ever been in a spot where you felt like you were in a tight spot, you need to make something happen, and or you've ever been a woman or a mom who has considered a side hustle or going into business or any of those things, I think you're going to love this conversation. One thing that happened after I stopped recording the interview is that I asked Barbara to think back to when she was about 16 years old and if she thought that younger version of herself could ever have imagined how her life was going to go. And she said something like, oh, heavens no. So on that note, it's time. Let's do this. Barbara Hempel, welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm happy you're here. Are you ready for a fun chat?
Absolutely, I am. Thank you, Amy, for having me so much. I really look forward to it.
Yay. Me too, Barbara. Me too. I start all of my interviews asking my guests what part of the world they call home. So share with us, where are you?
I'm in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Fantastic.
Two hours from the ocean and 3 hours from the mountains.
It's a pretty great location, Raleigh. I've not been there a lot, but every time I have, I've really enjoyed that part of the country. Sure. Yeah. So, all right. Next warm-up question. What is your favorite way to transition from busy time to downtime?
Playing the piano.
Oh, what a beautiful answer. As we're recording this, one of the kids is home and plays piano, and I had to remind her, I said, these are the quiet times during the day. All right. So topic of the day, not piano. All right. We're going to talk about a time when listening to people on a playground helped you to build a business and even start a worldwide organization. Before we dig into this, I want to give you a compliment. One of the things that was unusual about your pitch is that you were able to summarize about four decades of achievement into seriously 2 to 3 sentences and do it very well. That is very impressive. Gold star for you.
Oh, thank you.
Let's start with this. Rewinding the clock all the way back to 1978. What was it that had you sitting on a playground?
Well, my first husband and I lived in India for almost 5 years, and we adopted 3 orphan children, ages 2, 3, and 4. One with special needs. And we moved back to New York City, where he worked for a nonprofit organization and didn't make enough money to pay for living expenses in New York. So I needed to add to the family income, but I wanted my children to be first.
Okay.
So I decided a way to do that would be to find a problem in the world that I could solve that people would pay me for.
So I am going to ask you more details about that, because I think that that is a very, very good thing, very good question that you were asking. So I am generally a little curious if I can ask you a little bit about your personal backstory, because you told me in advance that in 1978, you and your husband moved from India to New York City. What is the background of that? There's no way to know. I don't want to assume, but did you grow up in India? What's the connection? How did get there?
Oh yeah, sure. It's a story that no one would believe. In fact, I'll tell you a little side story that kind of emphasizes it. I am now, that husband divorced me and married 2 other women. And the third woman that he was married to, he's now died and she's a widow. And I felt sorry for her. I reached out to her and we became friends.
Okay.
And she contacted me and said, I want to know, how did a Nebraska farm girl, I grew up on a farm in Nebraska.
Okay.
and an Iowa small town boy end up in India?
Oh my God. See, I'm glad I asked this. All right. So you guys both started in the Midwest of the United States, but you met in India.
No, we met in
Okay.
college in Iowa. We both went
Okay.
to a college in Iowa. It was a small, doesn't exist anymore. Well, it does. It's been rejoined again. It was Tarkio College. We went there. Now it's Tarkio Tech. It's in Iowa, and we both are in Missouri, Tarkio, Missouri. We both went to that college, and that's where I met. And it was during the Vietnam War.
Okay.
And he, that was when we had the word is, he was drafted.
Okay.
But he was a conscientious objector, did not believe in war, was willing to serve for the government, but not in the war. And at that time, you could appear before your draft board and apply for alternative service. And that's what he did. And we were assigned to work with an organization called Church World Service that was working with USAID, which is just
In
recently.
the news now, okay.
And
Wow.
distributing food. And so we our first assignment was actually in the island of Grenada in the West Indies. And we worked with food distribution, women. Like one of the things that I did was would go and meet with women to show them how to use the milk powder we distributed, because what would happen would be they would sprinkle enough powder in it for it to look white because they were trying to stretch it. And then the babies would starve. So it was my job to go and work with the women to show them why it was really important that they put everything in it so that their babies. When the war was over, we could have stopped that, but we enjoyed the work. And so we stayed there, and we were assigned to went from the smallest program in the program to the largest program in India. And that's how we ended up in India.
All right, very good. What did that is a wonderful story, actually. I'm really happy that I asked. And so, what did can I ask one more question about that? What did you were you already drawn to nonprofit work when you were a student, or was there what did you study?
I studied music,
Okay.
and my husband was planning to go to seminary, but then
Okay.
when he got into this work, he decided that he could make a bigger impact by doing things that were not particularly related to ministry.
Okay, so he was thinking about going to seminary and took a more boots on the ground activist
Exactly.
leg. Okay, all right, very, very good. Okay, so you guys travel across the globe and you're there and you adopt three children and you come back to New York City. He's an active, his job is an activist in a nonprofit scenario, something sort of epically famous for not paying very well. And New
That's
York.
true.
New York, one of the most expensive cities, I think, on the planet. So you and you find yourself, you've got three young kids in a city. So you are at the playground letting the kids be kids. You describe that you were on the playground listening to what was going on around you to discover a problem that you could fix. So this sounds to me like such an entrepreneurial, business-minded, financially forward, independent question to be asking in the playground, truly. And so, when the question is, and that's one of the reasons I was asking about your background, did you see yourself at that time as an entrepreneur or a business person? And do you have any background or family that was in business?
Well, I grew up on a farm. So if
Okay.
you're a farmer, you by definition are an entrepreneur. That's just the way. And my mother was the assistant to the owner of a small town bank for 46 years. And she actually did the management for the farms that the bank was managing. So I
Okay.
always said if she'd been lived in my age, she probably would have, in my era, she probably would have been president. She was incredibly intelligent, creative, just a wonderful, wonderful leader. And so I had a role model. And just to say, I started thinking that I would be at have a handy girl service because I did grow up on the farm. So I
Yep.
followed my daddy around and I knew how to do electrical repairs and plumbing and stuff. So I thought, oh, and I we were in a, there were five high rises that were all together. and we lived there. And and they were always talking about, small repairs. I thought, oh, I could do that, but you had to belong to the union. So it's like, okay, that doesn't work. So then it's like, okay, what is a problem? And I began to hear people talking about clutter and disorganization. Like we haven't filed their income taxes because I can't find the receipts, or I'm fighting with their kids about their messy rooms, or it makes me mad when my spouse drops his stuff on the dining room table or on the kitchen counter and I'm trying to cook, or we haven't had guests in forever because the dining room table is covered with papers. And I just thought, they didn't have my mother. And here's the thing that shocks everybody. I am not naturally organized. I have been diagnosed with ADHD. I'm a musician by training. I have a degree in music. I love to start things. I don't like finishing them. I love the big picture and I hate the details. So there is no one who can make a mess faster than me, but I was blessed to grow up in a family where we did things in systems. I can still hear my mother saying, if you're going upstairs, take something with you. And there were ways that we just did things, and I thought everybody lived that way. And then when I became a mother of young children, and I would go to other people's houses, it's like, oh, they didn't have my mother.
So you grew up on a farm. Tell us a little bit about the farm that you grew up on, because it was it's a little different than the way farming is today in the land we
Well,
live in.
originally, my father was a tenant. He and his father were tenant farmers. And they were very poor. My mother told me they had 13 cents in their pockets the day I was born. I was born 9 months and 15 minutes after they were married. And she said they didn't really intend to have a child and they weren't really ready for one yet, but they had a cellar full of food. It was 19 degrees below zero the day that I was born. And
Oh
I said,
my
I
goodness.
got cold and I've been cold ever since. But the farm, so they had a dairy farm. So
Dairy farm, okay.
like I was just telling somebody today that my father milked twice a day for 18 years and did not miss once.
Right. No, it's a commitment and a tie to the land. That's something that is livestock and keeps you
And
honest and
then
keeps you on a schedule.
they had other, we had pigs at different times. We had
Pigs.
pigs and chickens, and then he raised primarily corn and soybeans.
Okay.
And my brother died just a year ago, November. He lived on that farm, and his wife still lives there, and it's still farmed by her son. So the farm still exists.
That's amazing. That's not as common as I think it would have been 100 years ago. So, how many kids, you and your brother, just the two of you,
Yeah,
or are there more?
I had one brother 6 years younger than I.
Okay, so because it is a thing about you very accurately described farming as entrepreneurship. But I think that is for people who are not outside, who have not dealt with farmers, they may not actually have drawn that conclusion. Really hilariously, I grew up in New York City, and when I was in middle school, they gave us a job aptitude test. So it was like a survey what kind of job you would be good at. And the result came back that I should be a farmer, which was hilarious at growing up in New York City. And enough so that in the 1980s, my father was like, I have to figure this out. Like, I have to call the school and see what this means. Like, we have one plant in the entire house. This kid does not know how to grow anything. I remember in the lunchroom, the kid, everybody's getting it's doctor, engineer, nurse, teacher, and they're like, what, farmer? What? And I was the butt of the jokes. But it turned out that the translation was that I was well suited for entrepreneurship. And they just that was the thing. So I always tell people, I'm like, I found my way there, but I was also told it was where I was going to end up as a kid. But it's funny because the thing was farming. And it's like, as you're in total control and you have absolute responsibility for everything that happens on the farm.
Well, one of the reasons I admired my father so much because my brother wanted to go into farming, and my father begged him not to. He said, "This is a very difficult life. Please don't do that." He sent him to college, went to the University of Nebraska, and he said, "You can go to college, and if after you go to college you still want to be a farmer, then we'll do
We'll do it.
we'll do it." And so he went to college. He said, "That's the only thing I want to do." But the reason I admired my father so much was my father was very forward thinking. In fact, He dug terraces by hand on our land when nobody had heard of doing anything like that. It was rough land, and and when my brother got out of college, there would be things that my brother would say, "I think we ought to do this." And he'd say, "Okay, you're the college graduate, we do it." And not every father would do that.
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting thing. And so you came out of that, it sounds like, with, let's see, I'm going to say these things and you tell me if they sound like things that describe you, a very much, let's figure out how to get it done kind of attitude.
Absolutely.
Yep. And then also it sounds like a very much an awareness of let's look and see what the opportunities are here and what tools we have to solve it. So when you were sitting on the playground, instead of surrounded by moms and other children, I think you were very uniquely positioned to be like, let's listen and see what's going on here and what I can fix.
That's true. And the other thing that is on farm life is working together. You know,
Okay, yeah.
neighbors. So our nearest neighbors were like 4 miles away, and there were cases of where they had equipment that we couldn't afford, and we had equipment that they didn't. And so we would work together, and together we would farm the land because not everybody could afford all the equipment. And so we would do things together. So when I created a company, one of the very first values of the company is together we are better.
I think that's beautiful. One of the things that cracks me up very, very much, because I live in cities, but my mom's family's from the Midwest, so I have a very minimal exposure to agricultural life, just enough to know that it is a never-ending sequence of work, which you were highlighting with your dad and the milking. One of the things that it cracks me up is a couple of years ago, my suburban moms were all like, "We're going to get chickens and we're going to get chicken coops," and people would ask me, they're like, "Do you want to do this?" And I was like, "No, I would like for you to do it, and I will happily accept the eggs." But I was like, "I do not think that you understand exactly how much work this is going to be for you."
That's right. That's
I
exactly right.
know, and I hope they all enjoyed it and very, very cute. But I was like, "This is, they don't go on vacation or take naps, the chickens. They're there
That's
all the
exactly
time."
right. Yep.
All right. So the problem you pick up on the playground is that people were struggling with organization. I think that directly ties back to growing up on the farm, where of course your mom had to teach you systems because there was too much work to do on any given day.
That's right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And you had to, in order for the crops to grow and the cows to give milk, you couldn't do things randomly. I mean,
No,
you didn't plant the seed.
you do have to plan ahead. When my kids were little, we tried to start a vegetable garden. This is back to reasons Amy is not a farmer, one, two, and three. And so we planted a vegetable garden, and I did not have the patience to wait for these to grow, but they just take such a long time. And so I would always pick things way before, like, so carrots, like they get huge on top, and I would pick them and they'd be this big. You have to have a plan and you have to then follow the plan. I need like a see-through vegetable
And
garden. So
also, the other thing is, they don't all succeed, but you keep planting anyway because
keep planning.
you just keep planting. And there were years when crops got hailed out or flooded out or whatever, and but you just kept planting. And that's basically what I've done as an entrepreneur.
Well, I think that it has a lot of similarities. People smarter than me have said these things. So the organization is a problem. What made you, this is like back, this is thinking back then, what do you think made you think that you had the tools that would, and the con that would give you the confidence to sell this, sell anything, sell as a product?
I don't know. I guess, well, I do too. There was a book Stephanie Winston wrote, I call her the mother of our organization. She's not hasn't been around for a long time. I don't even know if she's alive. I tried to follow to get in contact with her years later to thank her because she had written a book called Getting Organized, and it was the first book that was ever written on the subject of organized. And
Marie Kondo, eat her heart out.
yeah, right. Well, I mean, I've
Yeah.
told many people, when people ask what I do, I say, "Have you heard of Marie Kondo?" And
Yeah.
most people, not everybody, most people, "Oh, absolutely." I said, "Well, I was her 47 years ago. 47 years ago, I ran a $7 ad that launched the industry. That's it." And Stephanie's book, I read Stephanie's book, and it's like, "Oh, that's common sense." I mean, everything in that book was what I thought was common sense because that was the way I'd grown up. And so that
Yeah.
was it. And then the other thing was I went to Riverside Church in New York City. We lived right across the street from Riverside Church. And
On 72nd?
on
Yeah. Seventy-seventh?
yeah,
Seventy-seventh?
no, it's what, a hundred, hundred and we were lived 125th Street. So it was,
Okay.
yeah,
Some way uptown.
175th,
175th.
175th,
175th. Okay.
175th. Yeah. And 125th, 125th,
125th, right by
125th. And,
Columbia.
yes, exactly. Right by Columbia. And that's where we went to church. And there was a woman there who did a lifestyle workshop. And we met one Saturday and five Wednesdays and another Saturday. And it was like, what do you want to do? What are you good at? So it was talking. And that was when I read that book and I presented that idea and that group. So I guess in a way, it was kind of like a mastermind group that said, you know, hey, you can do this. And so I started it. I took $7 out of the grocery money, which was a big deal because I used to walk 20 blocks because I didn't have 50 cents for the bus. And the ad said, disorganized. I organized closets, files, kitchens, you name it, call Barbara Hemphill. And there was a little freebie newspaper. I still have the original newspaper ad. It was called Wisdom's Child, and it was a free newspaper that would be like in the lobbies of apartment buildings and things like that. And I ran that article in there. I got two crank calls from guys trying to pick me up. Yeah, I mean, it's like who, you know, just really. I mean, I'd get so excited somebody call and he would go on and on about this, and this, and when can you meet? And so I would pretend that I was getting my calendar and say, well, I can do it. Oh, he said, well, I was thinking about Saturday night. And then I knew. He was like, okay. The third call was from a 55-year-old widow whose husband was a solar practitioner attorney and had died very suddenly and had left piles of paper everywhere. And they didn't
Wow.
have any children. So, in a lot of ways, I did what a daughter might have done. And she had not a clue about how to lived on the Upper East Side, was a very society oriented woman. When I walked in and saw the piles of paper, I thought, what in the world have I done?
So this is such an amazing story. And if, for the people who are listening in 2025, it's really easy to think that running an ad in 1978 is a totally different thing than what we would do today. But I really kind of think it's the exact same thing that we do today, just in a different way. How did you find the publication? Like, how did you decide that this was a publication that was even running an ad and how to
I
place an
just saw
ad?
it. It was free somewhere and I picked it up.
Picked it up and they said, if you want to place an ad, and you called them on the telephone because it's the old days, there was no email yet, and they said $7. Just a text-based, like, classified ad.
Yep. It was just a classified ad.
Did
Yep.
you get any help in figuring out what it would say or how to message it or any of these things?
No, because there wasn't, I mean, everybody thought I was crazy.
Who's everybody in this?
Well,
In
you
the
know, when I would talk to my friend, you know, just
yeah.
to people, other parents that
Yeah.
you'd meet when you're taking kids back and forth to school. My kids went to public school, PS 75. And so, you know, when I would talk, it's like, you're going to do what? And then we were only in New York for less than a year. And my husband got transferred to Washington, D.C.
Okay.
And so I called the Washingtonian magazine, which was the top, because they were, I thought those were, I needed wealthy people, right? You know, people who would have money. And that was a glossy magazine. And I literally called the editor of the magazine, and her name was Ann Zimmerman. And I got her on the phone and I said, I have just moved here from New York City and I have a service that I think would be of interest to your readers. And the lesson was, she never asked me, how long have you been in business or how many clients have you had?
There's more lessons in there than that, though. Like, you intuitively like crafted what we would call a media pitch. Like, and people pay to learn how to do this. Like, so I just moved. I think I have something that would offer to your readers. I mean, I'm honestly, in so many ways, I'm so seriously impressed by this that and you had tremendous I don't know what the word is, gumption, chutzpah, like put that in to be like, all right, I'm just going to look up the phone number and give him a call, and why not?
Well, that's been a theme, okay, because my first book, which was written in 1988, so that was 10 years later, was published by Dodd Mead, which was the back then the top publisher. They've been in existence since the 1980, I mean 18, so I don't know, some long, long time. They published my book, Taming the Paper Tiger. It was excerpted worldwide in Reader's Digest, which is like to die for, right? That's the good news. The bad news is the month that it came out in Reader's Digest, Dodd Mead declared bankruptcy. And so the book was nowhere to be found. And 10 years later, I met a woman in Paris, France, who said, I tried, I read the article and I tried to buy your book. So I needed to get the book published and I actually had to buy my own manuscript back. And I did. I bought my manuscript back. Well, then all I had was I didn't have any books still. I had the manuscript, but I didn't have any books. So I had to figure out how to do it. And I called Viking Office Supply out of California. And Mr. Irwin Helford was on the cover of this catalog that said, as I recall, if you buy $100 worth of products, we'd send you a clock or I don't know, something like that. I called him on the phone. This was day before the days of voicemail and secretaries and all that. I called at what would have been 7 o'clock in the morning in California. And said, my name is Barbara Hemphill. I've written a book which talks about the supplies that you sell. And I see that you're offering a clock, but this book tells people how to use the things that you sell. So why wouldn't you buy my book and give that to your clients? And I got an order for 27,000 copies.
Holy, oh my goodness, holy cannoli. All right, so that is phenomenal. All right, so the question that's bouncing around in my head is that, so did anybody ever, did you just naturally have this formula in your head, which is like, let me figure out what this person needs and offer to solve their problem for them? Or was it something that somebody taught you or you picked up in a book or something along the way?
Well, actually, now that you think about it, now my aunt had five children, and I used to go and stay with her, and I would always organize stuff. I mean, I would, because she wasn't organized, and I would go in, and I couldn't stand the cupboards and the closets. And so I'd go during summer when summer was out. And so I would organize her whole house. And then when I was in college, I went to Kansas City, and I worked as an au pair for a very wealthy woman. And she also was disorganized. And so I helped her organize. And then she went to Paris to study cooking. And I helped her organize all of her recipes. So everywhere I went, I was always helping people. I mean, in college, I helped organize the music library. I mean, it's just like everywhere I went, I would see how things could be more organized. So I just did it.
That is amazing. All right. So you mentioned that when you were in New York City, before you moved to DC, the people who were in your social circle as other moms, they sort of did not understand what you were doing. Did you, and you go on, so you start this organizing business, you move it to DC, it's growing. At any point, do you run into any other women who are starting up businesses, who are doing what you're doing, or do you continue to be the lone wolf?
Well, I was a lone wolf for a very long time, but I want to tell you one other one that was really significant. I went to the Small Business Administration in Washington, D.C. And I said, I've just started this business and I'm looking for some help. And they laughed me out of the room and said,
Really?
yes, this is not a business idea. Nobody is going to pay for organizing closets, cupboards, and files.
Well, so the Small Business Organization Association still exists, and they still do mentorship and all kind of things for people. But so now they would probably forward facing assign you to a mentor who, depending on who you got, might then tell you that they did not
That's right. Well, and
understand.
ironically, one of the people that I mentored 10, 12 years later actually went to the SBA and was given an award for her organizing business, which was based on what I'd started 10 years earlier.
It's not necessarily like it's just the people who volunteer to mentor in the organization are often very seasoned. It's who you want, right? But it does open up the definitely the potential for the person who's the mentor does not understand the business model of the younger person or the things that might come in. I mean, I imagine, you know, these days you've got somebody who's or 10 years ago, you'd have like, you know, a seasoned executive, and the person comes in and says, "I'm going to build a YouTube channel." The guy would be like, "I don't even know what that is," you know?
Well, they were men, okay? They were
Yep.
all men, retired
Yep.
male executives.
Yeah.
So to talk to a retired male executive about a service that's going to or that you're going to go to somebody's house and organize their closets and cupboards and kitchens was
Not on their awareness screen. All right, so the organizing business catches on, it grows, you write a book, and eventually you start a national association.
Let's back up just a
All right,
second.
let's back up.
The book is important because what I realized very quickly was that the number one organizing challenge wherever I went was paper.
Yeah.
And to ironically, in this day, even though we are theoretically in the paperless age, it still is. Because there is so much paper now, and the irony is that at the time I started helping companies organize, I worked with a software company to create, taking my book and turning it into software. And we tried to sell it. And they said to us, oh no, we're going paperless, so we don't need to organize the paper.
They didn't know that everybody was just going to print out all of
And
the stuff.
not only that, but with digital, you just have a bigger, faster, hidden mess. My business
Yes.
is based on four words, which I learned from clothes closets. Clutter is postponed decisions.
Very
The
okay.
reason your clothes closet fills up is you haven't decided whether you're going to lose the 10 pounds to get into your favorite pair of pants, or whether you're ever going to play tennis with that tennis racket that's been there forever, or the candlesticks that you got from Aunt Sally. You love Aunt Sally, but the candlesticks are not
Yeah.
really your style. But if she came for Thanksgiving dinner, she would be so happy if they were on the table. And then you go, now take it to the digital world. Now people wake up in the morning, pull up their email before they even get out of bed,
Yep.
and they go open, close, open, close, open, close. And 40 minutes goes by. They haven't made a single decision. And the only thing that's different is they feel depressed about how far behind they are.
That's there are days that start for me like that for sure. But I am lucky. When I was in my 20s, I was working for a boss, and he sent us to an organization seminar, like a half day seminar. He sent the whole office. I was the youngest one on the team. And one of the things they taught us was touch it once and make a decision, like every piece of paper and every email that went through. And
Okay,
the
so I have to interrupt you because that's what I say is one of the things that was taught
yeah.
that gets people off track. Because here's the story. If you put a pile of papers in your, and let's go back to the days of when it was, when you think about
Yeah.
this with the early 80s, people went to their mailbox and they brought the piles of paper out of the mail and put it on the kitchen counter,
Yeah.
right? And so you would rifle through it, but you didn't make decisions. You sorted it to figure out which was important and which wasn't, but you didn't really decide anything. So handle it only once didn't work because I would handle one, two, three, and then it was time to go get dinner or it was
Yeah.
time to whatever. And I never got to the bottom of the pile, which means I never got to the American Express bill, which I now didn't get paid and end up paying a penalty for it. So, or another one that, so that's one of the myths of organizing. Another one is a place for everything and everything in its place. That's ridiculous. I mean, life is messy. If you're a mother and you got young kids,
Yeah.
I mean, to say that is ridiculous. It's half right. There has to be a place for everything. The problem is not the clutter. Clutter happens. Everybody has clutter. Email clutter, paper clutter, everybody has clutter. The problem is when you choose to put it away and you don't have a way to put it. So a place for everything is critical. Everything in its place is timely. So one of the things we do with our clients is have them identify what level of clutter they're willing to live with. So in my own life, I'm not naturally organized at all. And if you come into my home on Thursday, you might, and my office, I have a home office, you might look around and say, they pay you money for what? Because I like to start things, I don't like to finish it, I spread things out. My daughter says to me, I have never seen anyone make such a mess when they're cooking because I pull out this bowl and that's not the right size. And then I do another one and I take the lid off the spice and I don't put the lid back on again. And so the kitchen just looks like a bomb has gone off in it. And so, but in my house, it's like it has to be cleaned up by the end of business on Friday and it has to take less than 30 minutes to do it.
Yeah, setting the timer. So the it's funny because in that seminar where we were, where I was the youngest person in the world, when they said that, like touch it once, everybody else I was with was like, this is such garbage. This doesn't work. But I had never had anybody tell me how to handle anything at all. And so I was like, I think this is very helpful, like strategies for dealing with the stuff on my desk. And so it's I think that I can see, you know. I did not have the perspective to see the flaws yet because it was like, yeah, absolutely. So very, very good. So you write the book, you get the book out there, you're in DC, it's growing. At one point, you start an association. Tell us about that, because I don't know very much about organizing as a business, other than I do bring people in to help me build my closets when I move. So.
Well, at the same time that I was in Washington, there were some women, three women in California, who were also beginning to organize. But back then, there was no way for us to communicate.
Yeah.
And so they did their thing, and I did my thing. And then eventually it got together, and then I became one of the founders of that organization, was obviously the pres and was the president of it back in the 90s for a while. So.
Amazing. Amazing. And it all started sitting on a playground, deciding to listen and for what people were needing and that you could solve. All right. So I think so when you think, because you're still doing things today, you're very involved. 2025, I think there's tremendous temptation to think that the way you did this and the things you did in 1978 are very different than the techniques that people are using to, you know, organize or even start businesses or grow businesses in 2025. But would you say, you know, like, would you say that the things have changed so much, or would you say that the nuts and bolts of what you did to get started are kind of almost the same as what you would do today?
Oh, absolutely. And I have trained starting in 1998. I started training other people to do what I do. So I've trained hundreds of women to become organizing consultants. And I still do. We have a company, I formed a company that does that. And that what's changed now is that we can now do it virtually, which was a huge different, huge jump forward. And it was wonderful we were doing it before COVID, because then when people need to have offices at home, we could help them. But the principles are the same. So clutter is postponed decisions is going to be true until the day we die. It's not enough to make a decision. You have to have a way to implement a decision. And we use SYSTEM, the acronym, which is saving you space, time, energy, and money. Every time there's something you have to do repeatedly, you need to have a system. There's the thing about believing in what you're doing. I mean, the main thing is, and it's loving what you do. I think if you go to, I do a lot of coaching of people for entrepreneurship. I do coaching for people to become entrepreneurs and also for people to write books because I feel really passionate that the biggest legacy you can leave in the world is your story. Everybody has a story. And when people want to write a book or they want to start a business, I always want to know the why. And if the only reason they want to do it is to make money, it will not ultimately succeed.
Yeah. So, and the why when you were on the playground, the why when you were in the playground was very much, you know, need based at that
It
time.
was.
You guys, you.
It was to make money, but there are ways to make money that you also believe in. If you're only trying to sell, and I have a very vivid personal experience of that. I was on Home Shopping Network. A company came to me that had worked with a very famous rich person, and they got me on Home Shopping Network. When they came to me with the idea, I knew in my heart of hearts it was not going to be successful.
Okay.
I did it anyway because of my own greed.
Oh, so you went on and you talked about organizing. You made a presentation on the Home Shopping Network. What a, that must have been very a lot of pressure.
Well, it was exciting. I was on twice. So it was a specific product. The company created a product. I knew the product wasn't going to work. That's what it was
Okay.
beautiful. It was gorgeous. And theoretically it worked, but I knew enough about organizing and people's habits to know that it wasn't going to. But I didn't want to say that because of
Yeah.
the idea. And you had to sell, you got to be on for 12 minutes and you had to sell X number of products. And the first time I learned a very important lesson because I was introduced as the paper tiger lady, because that's what I was called because of writing the book, Taming the Paper Tiger. And the first time on, we sold enough products to get to come on. The next time they introduced me as the author of Love It or Lose It, Living Clutter Free Forever. And that was not a brand. And we didn't sell enough to last. And it taught me the power of branding.
Wow, that's an amazing lesson. All right, that is those are all amazing stories, and I could talk to you all day. But in a minute, we're going to do the final questions. Before we do that, I want to give you a chance to directly talk about what you're doing today, and how you want people to find you and connect with you after the interview.
Well, my goal was to create a company that would exist after I was gone. And the reason was I took Sam Sandler sales training. He had been dead for 10 years and we were listening to his audio cassette tapes.
Okay.
And I said, that's my business model. I want to create a company that will exist when I die. And so I started training other organizers. And 20 years ago, I trained a woman who ultimately now owns the company that I created, Productive Environment Institute. So if I die tomorrow, the company will continue to exist because she's there. So I work with that company, encouraging them, whatever. But then I also work as a speaker. I speak a lot at conventions and to companies, going into companies and helping their employees understand how clutter affects them. It's training. It's really training for employees, teaching them how to make those decisions and how to create systems, both with physical information, with digital information. Part of the clutter, I wrote a book, Less Clutter, More Life, and the premise is that physical and digital clutter is a symptom of emotional and spiritual clutter. So the role I play now, I call Vision Accelerator. And I'm working with individuals and companies to overcome the blocks, the emotional and the spiritual blocks that are actually preventing them from being productive.
That's amazing. And I think there's actually a ton of research that shows that it can very much be like, clutter can stress you out. It can be not always like if the clutter is like, birthday party, it can be a sign of joy. But like generally speaking, sometimes it can be something that is building pressure and anxiety and just stuff. And that even though nobody, well, maybe some people do, most people do not get up and say, you know what I want to do today is get rid of the clutter. There's a lot of benefits to processing it and doing
So
that. All right.
we do what we call productivity parties in companies, and we turn
Okay.
it into events, and we do prizes, and we do all of that. And the phrase that I have heard literally hundreds of times is, oh, I feel so much lighter.
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody knows that when you've got like a messy kitchen or a messy desk and you do the work and you do that, I think that everybody knows that. And it's very helpful to have tools and resources and people who can help you when you're not able to make that jump or get started by yourself. It's a good thing. So you have a two we have two resources that you've made available for the audience, which is the Productive Environment Institute. You have a scorecard. Which is available, Soar to Success, The Art of Managing Information, I think. And then lesscluttermorelife.com is a 12-minute training where you can learn lots of things. So those are in the show notes for people can grab them. And the easiest way to find the links for everybody who's listening and, on the treadmill or in the car or whatever is always to be subscribed to the email directory at Amy says at imperfectadulting.com. And then you get the links in your email and you can just click on them. So it saves you after hunting them up. Thank you for those generous offers and all of the stories. Very, very good. Are you ready for the final three questions?
I hope I am. We'll see.
I know. Barbara was trying to get me to give her the questions in advance before we started. I said, no, they're under lock and key. You can't have them. People get nervous, but you won't be nervous once you hear how simple they are. All right. What is something that you like to do on a free day, a day where you don't have any commitments, chores, or responsibilities? What's fun just for you on a day off?
To get in my car and start driving,
Wow.
turning on music that I love to listen to, and just start driving and go wherever it feels like it. And if I see something that looks interesting, stop, talk to people, go have an interesting food, just have an adventure.
I love it. All right, very good. Okay, so do you read or listen to books these days? And if so, do you want to share the last book you read or listened to?
Oh, I read tons and tons of books. And the one that I've read recently that I just love is written by a friend of mine. And it's called The Unwork Matrix, The Unwork Matrix, Unwork Matrix by Melvin Pillay. And it's just an amazing book about how you can, the tagline for our company is accomplish your work and enjoy your life.
Okay.
And Melvin's book is about how you can organize your life so that you can accomplish your work and enjoy it.
Fantastic. All right. So if you get a last minute invitation to something that's like an afternoon barbecue where people are bringing stuff or a potluck dinner or something like that, what is something that you might bring on short notice?
Ooh, what a great question. I would probably I have a layered salad that's a lentil salad, so that would be something really
That's a go-to thing that you know how to make and you can throw
Yep.
it together. It's a very important thing to have. When you
Sure.
get that invitation, you got to have things that you can
That's
do
a good question.
on short notice. Like, yeah, I'm on my way. What am I going to bring? All right, very good. That's it. Barbara Hempel, thank you so much for being a wonderful guest today on the show.
Thanks for having me, Amy. It was a great conversation. I really enjoyed it. And thank you for the opportunity, Amy.
You're welcome. Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again, please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adult to your adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone. Signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.